Hi, this is Newt. 2020 is going to be one of the most extraordinary election years of our lifetime. I want to invite you to join my inner circle as we discuss each twist and turn in the race in my members-only Inner Circle Club. You will receive special flash briefings, online events, and members-only audio reports from me and my team. Here's a special offer to my podcast listeners. If you join the Inner Circle today at newtsinnercircle.com and sign up for a 1 or 2 year membership, I'll send you a free, personally autographed copy of my book, Gettysburg, and a VIP fast pass to my live events. Join my Inner Circle today at newtsinnercircle.com. Use the code FREEBOOK at checkout. Sign up today at newtsinnercircle.com, code FREEBOOK. This offer ends January 31st. On this episode of Newt's World, we have to recognize that in 2017, Americans were more likely to die of an opioid overdose than from a car accident. In fact, 1 out of every 96 Americans die from an opioid overdose. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, from 1999 to 2017, more than 700,000 Americans have died from a drug overdose. Among the 47,600 opioid-involved overdose deaths in the United States in 2017, 58.8% involved synthetic opioids, particularly illicitly manufactured fentanyl, which has been fueling the U.S. overdose epidemic. The opioid mortality rate contributed to the third straight yearly decline in life expectancy in the United States. The opioid crisis is now an epidemic. But this isn't just about drug addiction. It's also about our national security. We are never going to resolve this crisis until we address the drugs coming over our southern border. Mexico has become what some would describe as a narco state. We'll talk about policies that need to change in order for our government agencies to fight this war. I'm pleased to welcome my guests, Missy and Michael Owen, co-founders of the Davis Direction Foundation, and Sarah Carter, an investigative journalist who reported from the border for over 10 years. She is currently a Fox News contributor and host of the Sarah Carter Show podcast. I really appreciate the two of you sharing because I know it's very personal. Tell us how you got so involved and why you were so concerned about the opioid crisis.
In March of 2014, we lost Davis, our 20-year-old son, to a heroin overdose. And at that point, we didn't have anywhere to turn to for information. We didn't have anybody that we could reach out to. And if we had had somewhere to turn or reach out and ask for information, we could have had a totally different outcome. But back then, the stigma was so great, and nobody wanted to let people know that in their family there was somebody who was addicted to drugs.
Davis initially encountered the drugs just in the family medicine cabinet while he was looking for something to help him sleep at night.
I did not have my medicine cabinet cleaned out, and honestly, the pills that he started with were from an old C-section that I had had, and my youngest daughter at the time was 14 years. That means I had leftover medication of 14 years in my medicine cabinet.
That's a real lesson for everybody who's listening, that you probably don't realize what you have sitting around. I know that Davis, as I remember, he played baseball. He was class president at Kennesaw Mountain High School. He edited the yearbook. He gave the commencement speech. He made the dean's list his first semester at Kennesaw State. Given all of that, it must have been very troubling for you and almost a shock to have to then start dealing with addiction. Can you talk a little bit about what happened to him and the challenges that families have when they suddenly are faced with this with somebody that they truly love?
We want to let people understand what this looks like and feels like.
We were the typical family working, responsibly raising children. And I would say, for me as a father, the first thing that I started noticing was a lot of sleeping late, missing family responsibilities and obligations that we would consider to be normal around the house. And that just continued to get worse. But again, you don't know what you don't know. I was not well-versed in the field of addiction and especially opiates. So for me, getting up every day and making a long commute and sitting in traffic 1 hour, you know, each way every day, there's very little of time to spend at home to find out what's going on. And then as it progressively got worse, things started going missing around the house. And believe it or not, a big one that I don't think any normal family would ever consider would be utensils. And one of the utensils was spoons. And it was like, where the heck are all of our spoons going? Missy, you want to add anything to that?
Anytime there's a change in behavior, the thing that I noticed most is that Davis was withdrawing from our family while the rest of us were upstairs talking or watching a show together. He was downstairs, and he spent most of his time downstairs in his room, and he didn't really want to socialize with us or be around us. But looking back over what I've learned because of the disease and being involved with the foundation, he didn't want to be exposed for us to see him and what was going on and the changes that were taking place. So it was easier for him to stay away from us than to be around us. That was really hard. That was really hard. We were a very, very close family. He didn't want to be a part of us anymore, and that hurt.
There's a certain amount of withdrawal or conflict that almost goes with adolescence. And so trying to detect the difference between healthy and unhealthy separation, if that makes any sense?
Well, the thing there, Newt, was that he was also withdrawing from his siblings, and that wasn't a part of adolescent behavior. Yes, withdrawing from your parents, I can understand, but the siblings were noticing him withdrawing as well, and we'd always been there for each other. With him playing baseball, we'd always been at all his games. I had a cheerleader, and we'd always been at all her competitions. I had a performer, we'd always been at her competitions. And when either of the other two boys were doing anything, we were there to support each other. And all of a sudden, Davis stopped supporting.
If somebody came to you and they were at that exact moment with their own child, what would your advice to them be?
To educate themselves. Know what you're dealing with. Like Michael said before, we didn't know what we didn't know. And there was so much that I didn't know, because when you're in the midst of active addiction with a family member, you are so consumed with chasing that family member, trying to find out who they've been with, where they've gone, how many miles were put on their car, did they answer their phone, did they not answer their phone, who were they calling, who were they seeing, all these kind of things, because you knew there was addiction involvement at that point. And instead of investing in the education of how to help them, you're just consumed with trying to protect them. And you have to stop and draw some serious boundaries and educate yourself as to what's available in the community, what is available outside of the community, and how to best help your child instead of chase your child.
I think that's really an important distinction. So in that context, if somebody came to you right now and said, my teenager is now increasingly withdrawn, and I'm worried that they might be into an addiction, but I don't know whether I should confront them or what I should do, what would your advice to them be?
Very clearly, I would say you need to come up to the zone and you need to talk to one of our peer support specialists, someone who has been in active addiction and has come out on the side of recovery and is practicing long-term recovery. You need to talk to them and get their perspective and understand what is going to help and what is not going to help. And that's where our peer support specialists are so important, Newt, because there's almost an automatic trust in someone who's been there. If you're looking for how you're going to get to the successful end of the story, and you've been in the pits of hell for all practical purposes, you want that person who's had the experience. And, you know, peer support specialists are the people that you need to go to. This is an evidence-based approach, and they are listened to more intently. They will tell you, and they have no qualms at all about laying it all out on the table, because they know that addiction is the hardest thing they've ever conquered, and all they want to do is help somebody find their way into the journey of recovery.
To me, looking back, the biggest thing that I would have tried to change with our son would have been the open line of communication. And that's where you start talking about this whole field of addiction and it being labeled as a disease, and the science gets better and better. But as a family, and not knowing and understanding this, there's a lot of behavioral type conversations, right? As you start learning more, and as you start trying to be a more responsible parent and not really understanding this, it starts shutting down the communication. And that probably did more harm, at least from my side, than anything, because what was needed was the open communication to get help. Because without me understanding what exactly was going on, all I was doing, and I will freely admit it, was shutting down the communication by coming up with responsibilities, you have to be on top of this and that, and blah, 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 without truly understanding the root cause in terms of what was going on here. And that was never going to happen, because by that time, there was no way in this world my son was going to openly communicate with me in terms of his struggles.
Coming up, after the death of their son, Davis, Missy and Michael Owen devote their lives to educating others about addiction by founding the Davis Direction Foundation. When it comes to your estate planning, why not leave behind a lasting legacy that will also make a significant impact? After all, we can't take our money with us, but we can use it to improve the lives of the precious animals who call Delta Rescue home. Delta Rescue is the only no-kill care for life home for more than 1,500 dogs, cats, and horses. Founder Leo Grillo left a career in Hollywood to devote his life full-time to caring for these beautiful creatures. Delta Rescue is located on a 115-acre mountaintop ranch in Los Angeles, beautifully landscaped and surrounded by rolling hills. The perfect sanctuary for our lost furry friends. You know how I feel about animals. They are pure souls who only want to give love and get love unconditionally. What Leo Grillo is doing at Delta Rescue is beyond extraordinary, helping to save and care for these innocent creatures so they can live safely and in peace. For more information, go directly to deltarescue.org/newt and request our free estate planning package. That's deltarescue.org/newt. And, due to the overwhelming response over the holidays, the free movie, The Rescuer, is still featured on our website. It's an award-winning documentary about Leo's two-year journey to rescue a family of 21 dogs abandoned in the wilderness. Stream it for free now. Go to deltarescue.org/newt today. Make it your New Year's resolution. So you then create the Davis Direction Foundation. How did you pick the title?
Well, Davis, of course, is our son's name. And then Direction, when we started, we picked a logo that was moving onward through life, looking upward to God. And that's what we had to do. We knew we had to move onward, and the direction needed to be onward and upward. And we looked to God for leadership, guidance, and just kind of took his lead as to what needed to happen. And that's how we came up with the name, the Davis Direction Foundation, because people need direction when they're going through addiction. And direction was one of the things that, as families, we did not have when we were trying to navigate this journey.
You have a set of key principles. I remember coming to the zone. Could you describe the zone for a minute?
Sure. The Zone is a 21,000 square foot building that has a top floor and a bottom floor. The top floor is the recovery center. You walk in and we have the wonderful coffee shop on the right with the aroma of coffee as you enter the building. And that's where people meet to do step work and just connect and get a cup of coffee and share stories. Then next to that is the meeting room. We offer like 36 meetings per week, and they include all pathways to recovery. We don't discriminate there. We have a music room where we have instruments and people come in and play guitars and somebody will hear the music. We have a drum set. We have pianos and people come in and one just joins in with the other. And before you know it, we have a whole jam session going. Then we have a computer lab and research library where we have people come in and write resumes, connect with their families via Facebook or email, because many times people with the disease of addiction are not allowed in their homes because of the fact that they've stolen from their parents, they've been banned from the home, because a lot of people don't understand this disease and how to deal with it. Also, there are younger children in the homes that parents don't want their addicted family member around. And so that's one way that they can connect with their families. We also have a resource library where you can read all kinds of things. We have self-help books, we have nutrition books, things that would help people going through the disease and trying to navigate into recovery. We have big books and Bibles and whatever they may need. But then we have arts and crafts room, we have a big kitchen, we have a workout gym that's comparable to any professional workout place. And we have a game room with pool tables, ping pong tables, every video game that you've ever heard of. And we have a room where we have chiropractic treatment going on. We have recovery coaching rooms that are smaller where it can be an intimate recovery coaching session with one of our certified recovery coaches and a person coming in to seek those services. And then we just have a foyer where a lot of good stuff goes on and people come in. And sometimes all they need is just to connect with somebody else in recovery and get a smile and a good word and be on their way. The bottom half is a thrift store that we've developed that people donate to us all the time. And the funding that we make through this thrift store goes directly to support the mission of the Zone, which is recovery. When Davis was going through his addiction in 2014, there were no places like the Zone where you could go knowing that there was a person in recovery who would talk to you. So now that recovery support organizations are popping up throughout the country, that is such an added blessing because you know now where you can go to receive that service.
When you talk about recovery support, is that primarily for the person who's addicted, or is that for the whole family?
It's for the whole family. Addiction is a family disease, and everybody in the family needs to know how to support it, what's available, and what their responsibilities are if you want the truly best outcome. And yes, of course, there are going to be more services and support for the person with the disease of addiction, but if you don't have family buy-in, your chance of success is so much less. It's almost like education. All of the statistics that show when you have parental support toward education, your child is way more successful. Well, the same thing's true with addiction. When the family is on board working to support and help and find resources for that struggling family member, there's going to be way more success than if the family turns the back, because that just enforces the theme of shame and enforces the stigma of addiction.
So you emphasize, which would work, of course, in Georgia, that if I had this challenge in my family, I could come to the Zone. Can people contact the Zone to find out if there's a similar support system near them if they're in a different state?
Absolutely. And I'd like to point out we have a Facebook page called Davis Direction Foundation. And on that Facebook page, we have almost 11,000 members. And because of the membership that we have there and the extensive work that we've done throughout the country, we know somebody that's going to know somebody who is familiar with the resources almost anywhere in the nation.
If somebody does come to you for help, how do you work your way through that? And what makes you different from the more traditional or the older established systems?
The fact that we're working with peer support specialists. The old and traditional way is having counselors or therapists or people, even doctors, who you would turn to for treatment. They don't have the lived experience. They don't have the lived experience of being a person in addiction or being a family member who has supported someone with the disease of addiction. And there are a lot of studies that go back and show that doctors really don't understand addiction in the way that they should in order to treat it. For instance, there was a study that came out that showed that one Advil and one extra strength Tylenol were a far superior physical pain reliever than a 10 milligram oxycodone. And when they did the survey to show how many doctors knew that, it was less than 1%. So the traditional way that we used to have of people trying to seek help, they were talking to somebody who really should have said, I really don't know how to help you. And instead, they continued to address the mental disease or the mental health part of the disease, which if somebody is self-medicating or somebody had depression or anxiety issues to begin with that led to the self-medication, then doctors would try to treat those symptoms in lieu of the addiction symptoms. And that was a real problem. So to be able to talk to somebody who has had the disease and the lived experience has proven to be a way better model than traditional treatment.
This whole concept of medication-assisted treatment as opposed to a purely psychological approach, do you want to comment on that and where you are in your own thinking on that topic?
Medically assisted recovery, as we call it, is so underrated in the medical world, but we have studies that show that if you are on buprenorphine, you're 50% more likely to stay in recovery than if you are going detox and abstinence alone, which has a 10% rate to stay in recovery. So the more we find out about it, the more promising it looks. The medical world has just come out with a new injection for buprenorphine called Sublocade. And Sublocade, if it weren't so expensive, of course, would be such a blessing to so many people. For instance, because if you went into any emergency department looking for help for opioid addiction, and you could get the Sublocade injection, it lasts for 30 days, and it helps you with the withdrawals, and it keeps you with enough of the opioid in your system that you're not actively seeking to pursue addiction. So what that would do would give you 30 days to get treatment set up and in order and ready to go with a plan. That would be just life-changing for people with the disease of addiction to be offered that injection. But, of course, money stands in the way. And so often we hear about money standing in the way, bureaucracy standing in the way. And that's one reason that we need to start letting people who are the boots on the ground in this arena to start taking charge and getting rid of the bureaucracy and everything else that surrounds it that people have to answer to and deal with and report to in order to help somebody who's seeking help and all they want to be is out of active addiction.
As I understand it, one of the major differences between alcoholism and opioids is that the receptors in your brain adjust themselves to the opioids in such a way that if you don't have some kind of medication assistance and you go off and detox, your brain gradually loses its capacity to absorb the level of opiate that you were used to. So if you do backslide, you have a very real danger that you're going to end up with a condition in which you take what you used to be able to do, but because you're no longer adjusted to it, you actually end up killing yourself. So there's actually a very high percentage of people who go into rehab, detox, come out, and because they don't have any kind of medication support, they end up taking a fatal dose. Is that a pretty accurate description?
Yes, it is. But I will tell you that what happens is people who are in active addiction, their brain becomes hijacked. It's damaged. We have scientific visuals that show the damage that happens in an opioid addiction brain. And so I guess the body has recovered somewhat, but the brain has not. So the brain tells you, go back to that old dosage, and your body has come with a tolerance to the medication that you don't have anymore. So you overdose and die, and that's exactly what happened to Davis. He had been in recovery for almost 6 weeks when he took his fatal overdose.
What can other people do to serve the community?
Education is the biggest thing, always. Educate yourself and be supportive. Like, we say that people get sober in treatment, but they get well in communities that embrace recovery. And to embrace recovery as a community, you have to be educated. So when we have a symposium or we do an event, come out, because we're always educating at these events. There's a product that we talk about all the time called Dispose RX. Dispose RX is a little packet that you pour in leftover or unused medication that deactivates the active ingredients in the medication. You fill it with water and shake it up, and then it turns it into a gel, and you can dispose of it safely in your own garbage can. But if those medications were to stay in the family medicine cabinet, there's a statistic that 75 to 85% of all heroin addiction began in the medicine cabinet. So let's get that unused medicine out of the cabinets. I can't tell you how many times somebody has said after they had an event where family or friends came over that there was missing medication. So let's get that medication out of the medicine cabinets. That could be world-changing. And then, of course, donating to boots-on-the-ground organizations, places that you know people are making a difference. Visit them, support them, and just allow them to do what they do to support people who are actively seeking their services.
We will link to the foundation, so anybody who wants to will be able to click straight from us to you in terms of donating money and getting involved.
Thank you so much, Newt.
Coming up, Sarah Carter makes the case for Mexican drug cartels to be designated as foreign terrorist organizations. Deborah's home was stolen. I don't mean thieves stole stuff. I mean scammers literally stole her home. The FBI calls home title theft one of the fastest growing white collar crimes. This story is why you need Home Title Lock. Deborah says criminals found the title to our home online and filed fraudulent documents claiming they owned her home. Wait, it gets worse. Deborah says, I was evicted from my own home and $85,000 in equity. Gone. Nobody believes you can get your home stolen this easily. This is why you need to get Home Title Lock, because no insurance or bank protects your home from title theft. First things first, go to HomeTitleLock.com and register your address to see if you're already a victim and don't know it. Then sign up to help protect the legal title to your home, so you don't end up like Deborah. And to get you started, you'll receive 60 risk-free days of protection. Go to HomeTitleLock.com. That's HomeTitleLock.com. Could you share with us how you got into the whole business of investigative reporting and over the years, what you have focused on?
In 2004, 2005, I told my editors, I want to go to the U.S.-Mexico border. I want to go to Mexico. I want to find out what the real story is here. That began my long career. And when I reached the border, I saw things that I never thought existed. I could even imagine the security failures, the loopholes, the porous border situation, Mexican military in the pocket of the drug cartels, people on our side of the border in law enforcement in the pocket of the drug cartels because they've amassed so much money. They've been able to buy people. They've been able to blackmail people. The inability for us to actually match the resources that the drug cartels had, and the very real and dangerous situation that our nation faced. September 11th, 2001, I think, was a wake-up call for everybody in this nation that there were enemies out there, and these enemies lived in the shadows. There were these drug cartels that, without any ideology whatsoever, with no loyalty to neither their country, nor ours, nor humanity, were willing to do anything and everything for money and power. And that means being able to transport anything that they wanted if the price was high enough across the U.S.-Mexico border. So I spent my career there at the border covering stories from California near the Tijuana estuary all the way up to Matamoros, Mexico, along the Texas border. I remember I came across tunnel systems. I interviewed criminals on the Mexican side of the border getting ready to come into the United States. I uncovered the fact that the Mexican military had actually assisting the drug cartels at that time, moving their contraband in here. It opened up a huge, wide range of stories. I plan on going to Mexico this year. I know the situation is extraordinarily dangerous, but I think it's worth the risk because this is a story that affects our security as Americans. These people operate like terrorists, and the only way that we can fix this is by telling the truth and getting that information out to the American public so that they can make the right decisions with their leadership on how to handle it.
When you look at all this and you look at how, in many ways, the cartels have gotten stronger, more violent, and more dangerous, what do you see as the strategy that will break them?
I think the only way to break these guys is to target their finances and to put them on the line. That means designating them foreign terrorist organizations, telling them that we're not going to put up with this anymore. This isn't going to be the same decades-long battle that we've seen in the past because it's never going to end. We have to let them know that we mean business, that we are going to take them on, and that they will not get away with this. We have a president now that can do this. And I know he's deliberating this right now. But the most important thing is to realize that the only way to combat these people at this point in time is to put them on notice, to put them on call, and to say, this is unacceptable. We are not going to do this anymore. We're not going to lose hundreds of thousands of our citizens because you're poisoning our country, and now you're bringing in and you're manufacturing fentanyl, a deadly synthetic opioid. You've crossed all lines, and they understand that. Believe me, when they see that FTO designation, they will understand that. We've seen this in the past. We have people there right now, great men and women, training and assisting the Mexican government. But Manuel Lopez Obrador, the president, does not want to do his job. He wants to play this game and placate the drug cartels, and that can't happen anymore.
In a situation where you have the Mexican president opposed to you, how do we operate?
Look, the Mexican government, unfortunately, because this has been so exacerbated for decades, have become a part of the problem. And I say this because they've basically been bought, some of them, not all of them. There are some great people in the federal government that want to fight this, but their lives are on the line. Their families are being threatened. Every time they raise their hand to the drug cartels or try to stop it, something happens. A politician gets targeted or killed. Reporters are killed. One of the most dangerous places in the world to report from is Mexico. You're putting your life on the line every time you cross into Mexico as a journalist to tell the story. Brave journalists from Mexico have been killed or injured, or their family members have been killed. So this is a very serious situation. What has happened in Mexico is effectively a shadow government, and some would say a narco state. So it's understandable why President Manuel López Obrador would be so frightened of taking them on. We've seen it in the past. We've seen them strong arm. We've also seen them buy out people, very high-level officials. So in an effort to target them, we need to go one level up. We need to say, you know what, not the same game. We're not going to wait for Mexico to throw us a bone like El Chapo after decades of running the Sinaloa cartel. He figures even the Mexican government and people in there, remember, they're playing games with other cartels here. They'll throw us a bone. They'll throw us Chapo. Chapo has outlived his time. He's caused too much trouble. Let's throw the U.S. a bone, and then they'll get quiet again. We can't get quiet anymore. We need to focus on these terrorists, which is what they are, these mass murderers. We need to tell them, we are at war with you. Not just our government, but the people of America need to stand up and say, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. This isn't just about drug addiction. This is about you poisoning our country. If we don't do something, we're taking a gamble. The United States government has the resources and the capacity to target these cartels. We have very well-trained military personnel. We also have people within the DEA, within the FBI. And if our agencies could for once just cooperate and work together and be held accountable, that's the big thing here. We are never going to resolve the crisis until our agencies are held accountable and can show actual progress, that they're working together to target them. So even if we designate them foreign terrorist organizations, if those agencies aren't sharing information and cooperating together, we're not going to be successful. The only way we're going to be successful is if we work together to find a common solution. And if we designate them foreign terrorist organizations, and I'm talking about maybe the top three or the top four drug cartels in Mexico, we seize their accounts. We seize where they're laundering their money. We seize those businesses. We work with the Mexican government and we root out corruption inside Mexico and inside the United States. Then we can make progress.
Well, look, I want to thank you.
Thank you so much, Newt.
Next, what we can do to protect all Americans from the opioid epidemic. Hi, this is Newt. I'd like to invite you to join my Inner Circle. It is a digital subscription club where you go beyond the Newt's World podcast to access extra content on the topics you enjoy, attend member-only online events, and get my political analysis and context on the 2020 election. Go to newtsinnercircle.com and become a member. It's a place for you to get involved, share ideas, and learn from my team of experts. Join the Inner Circle today at newtsinnercircle.com. The first 500 yearly subscribers will receive a limited Newt's Inner Circle gift as part of their membership. Join newtsinnercircle.com today. That's newtsinnercircle.com. We've theoretically been fighting a war on drugs at least since the early 1970s. but we remain the primary purchaser. So to some extent, the system exists because Americans are willing to pay money to sustain the system. And I think there are four parts to this. One is, what's our strategy for helping Mexico become a healthy state again? What is our strategy for stopping or dramatically limiting the flow of drugs? What's our strategy for destroying the cartels? And then what's our strategy for the kids? If you look at the number of suicides and the number of drug addictions, there is a spiritual crisis here that doesn't fit our political language, but that's real. Any serious American strategy has to take into account those kind of challenges. We have no strategy either for drug addiction in America or for defeating the cartels in Mexico. And that puts us, I think, at real risk. Thank you to my guests, Missy and Michael Owen and Sarah Carter. You can read more about the Davis Direction Foundation and get a link to the documentary, Not in Vain, on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Westwood One. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers, and our producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our editor is Robert Borowski, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. Our guest booker is Tamara Coleman. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. The music was composed by Joey Salvia. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360 and Westwood One's John Wardock and Robert Mathers. Please email me with your comments at newt@newtsworld.com. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World. The Westwood One Podcast Network.
On Westwood One Podcast Network.
Every day I pass by this giant billboard that advertises a rehab facility. It says, end the addiction, which just seems like false advertising because opioids are killing more people now than car accidents. It's time to figure out how we, as a society, have gotten here. This is Last Day. Subscribe today wherever you get your podcasts.